From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made a week ago when the Wall Street Journal published a story that came with this stunning headline: Helping Bosses Decode Millennials for $20,000 an hour. $20,000 an hour? Apparently some corporate executives are so desperate to understand what millennials want that they will spend big money to find out. Who are these creatures, these millennials? Do they hunt and gather? Do they use common language? How do they do that? Well, here are three things that those corporate execs learned by spending $20,000 an hour. First, millennials want work to be meaningful. They want a lot of feedback, maybe more than most previous generations, and they despise voicemail. Now, let's be fair. Despising voicemail is not the exclusive right of millennials. We all get to partake in that. Me too. But this past Thursday, WXXI's Need to Know hosted a discussion on what millennials want and need from the workplace, and we've seen a wide range of responses, from supportive and open-minded to the kind of millennial stereotyping that has become rather common. So this hour, we thought we'd open up the conversation to our listeners and bring the panel in for an extended discussion. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests. Anna Liss is here, the Managing Director of Business Development at Greater Rochester Enterprise. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Seth Eshelman's here, the founder of Stash. What is Stash, Seth?
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Stash, as far as the company, like, what do we do?
Yeah, what do you do?
Stash is a multidisciplinary design firm focused in interiors, product design, furniture design, and also the manufacturing of those products.
Very good. Andre Primus is here, the founder and director of RockShare. Andre, welcome.
Thank you.
And a reminder of what RockShare is.
RockShare is my organization that we help promote sharing economy and alternative economy systems in Rochester.
Okay. Well, Anna on various social media sites has already been sharing what I've seen in a lot of places today, which is Farhad Manjoo's piece in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Anna, Farhad is taking aim at people who want to overgeneralize millennials. He's saying, come on here. It's not like a super monolithic group. You can't just talk about millennials as a group. So to some degree, I'm guilty of that too. But what did you make of Farhad's piece?
That's
in the New
right.
York
so the piece is called Corporate America Chases the Mythical Millennial.
Yep.
And Manjoo calls it a dubious idea that young people are in the cultural vanguard. He mentions the point that you brought up, Evan, that companies are hiring these $20,000 an hour consultants, which is, he deems, a waste of money because millennials aren't real. He says if your management or marketing theories involve collapsing all millennials into a catch-all anthropological category, as if you're dealing with space aliens, you're doing it wrong. And that's true. I mean, I think our generation is, like, back in the day, Gen X was called slackers, and now they're considered workaholics. This
to
is part of the
degree,
general evolution.
I agree. I think to some degree, we always want to take aim at the youngest work generation and say that they just don't have it.
It's true.
So you agree with Manjoo in that front there?
Absolutely. I'm guilty of rolling my eyes whenever I see an article about millennials analyzing us, putting us into these broad brush categories. Each of us has a unique story, a unique experience. You know, the one common denominator I think that's most significant is that we all came of age in the work world under the banner of the Great Recession. So we dealt with some issues there, dealing with student loan debt, putting off major life decisions. But these are all things that are starting to, we're seeing the trends sort of, the trend line kind of swinging upwards. I think more and more millennials now are starting families. About 38% of us that have bachelor's degrees are buying houses now. So things are starting to settle down. We're growing up.
Okay. And so let me kind of do two things that seem contradictory, but I hope they're not. Number one, I want to endorse the Farhad Manjoo article that Anna's talking about. And by the way, if you want to check it out, well, we'll post it on our Twitter account. So what's the name of the article, Anna?
It's called Corporate America Chases the Mythical Millennial.
Okay.
It was published today.
It's a good piece. And I endorse the idea. I don't want to overgeneralize. But having said that, I think it's also okay to recognize that every generation does have some differences, and expectations for the workplace do evolve over time. So at some points of the discussion this hour, we'll have to kind of check ourselves and say we're overgeneralizing a little. But other times, I think it's fair to say that there are some interesting differences, some interesting changes. And so let me kind of hit on a few of those here, and I'll go around the table. Seth, to you, if someone were to say, well, hey, you know, as a millennial and, you know, as an executive.
Executive, right.
There you go. And as someone who's worked, you know, has millennials working with and for, Do you see a generational shift at all? Is it fair to ask what millennials want in the workplace?
It's tough because Stash is such a value-driven company in the first place, and I'll be totally forthright. I've never had a real job. I founded Stash when I was 21, leaving RIT as an industrial design student, and I that was the first thing that I ever did as a as an adult in the workplace. So,
why did you put adult in air quotes, man? I mean, like, it's a real job. You're working.
It's true. No, I am. But it's tough to define it as work when you love what you do every day. You know, that's a really tough thing to quantify.
Such a millennial thing to say, man.
I know, right? Just a walking stereotype.
But I think what you also seem to be saying is you haven't had a litany of jobs in different workplaces to kind of compare from. That this has been what you've been doing since graduating, yes?
Exactly, yeah. But the one thing that I can say is at Stash, we've been able to build that culture around how we feel our employees want to, or why they want to be there. What do they want to do? What do they want to get out of their position at Stash? Or what project do they want to work on? And trying to figure out the values that those employees embody themselves and how that can be brought into the workplace and how we can build our company culture around that.
Okay. Andre Primus, is it fair to ask what millennials want in the workplace these days?
I think so. I think that I mean, overgeneralizing can be useful sometimes. And I think that really, though, it's just, what millennials are doing is they're expressing things that everyone has thought, but that not everyone thought they could have. You know, I think that I've heard people say that millennials are entitled. But if you're talking about, you know, work-life balance and meaning in work, everyone's entitled to those things. Millennials are just the first to really ask for it harder than some of the other generations.
I think that's an interesting point. I think these two things don't have to be mutually exclusive, that millennials can show more entitlement than other generations, broadly speaking, but that that's not necessarily just selfish or a bad thing, that that could be a societal shift toward more work-life balance or a recognition that, you know, that's not to say that not having a work ethic is important, because that's another slur against millennials, that there's no work ethic, and we'll talk about that. That's obviously unfair. But, Andre, do you think that there's value in the millennial generation saying we do have a sense of entitlement that work-life balance, time off, you know, not being always at work or always working?
I do think that there's value in that, and I think that it's value that's going to transfer to other people. I think it's going to transfer to, you know, there are some people who, because of the recession, are entering back into the workplace who weren't in the who had been in it before and are entering back in as older people. And I think that they're going to reap some of the benefits of millennials, you know, making room for people to have more work-life balance. And same thing, I've been saying, people who come from socially, you know, minority groups and groups that might, you know, people who have children, things like that, people who have, you know, been marginalized in the workplace can benefit from the stuff that millennials have been pushing for.
All right, so Anna Liss, who's the Managing Director of Business Development at Greater Rochester Enterprise, from your perspective in the business world, how is the business world grappling with what Andre just described, which is not a desire to not work or a desire to be lazy or to not have a work ethic, but to kind of push back on the expectation that, hey, be happy to have a job, work 60 hours a week, you know, break your back, everybody's got to do it for years. Millennials are more likely to say, that's not cool. And is the business community, do they have to make an adaptation to that? I mean, what's the dynamic there?
Sure. So we already addressed the point that some big companies are paying consultants to help them become friendlier workplace environments for millennials.
$20,000.
Yeah, that's a little much.
Yeah.
So I'm going to draw on an example. Recently, the Great Places to Work organization came out with a list of 100 most favorable workplace environments for millennials. One insurance company, Acuity, includes all levels of their workers in strategic planning processes to give them skin in the game. Workday, which is an electronic payroll and scheduling company, offers a Generation Workday program for college students and recent graduates. They offer mentoring. Every employee from the CEO on downwards gets the same same bonus every year, $1,500. Boston Consulting Group has revamped their recruiting and training to address the needs and expectations of millennials. They do they use peer relationships to promote their recruiting cycle. And then it's true from the management side, as well as probably more significantly on the consumer and retail-based economy. Whole Foods just announced that they're going to be introducing a chain of smaller urban-based stores called Whole Foods 365 that are going to offer craft brew bars, self-serve tea kiosks. They're trying to cultivate a cooler, hipper environment to attract millennials because their stock is currently in the bargain bin and they need to target our generation. So companies across the board are working hard to be more conducive to our generation. And those that do are actually scoring higher on benchmarks that measure their capacity for innovation, and their profits are actually higher than companies that are remaining the same and not bending.
I learned a number of things in the conversation on Thursday night on Need to Know, hosted by our colleagues Sasha and Simons, not the least of which is that currently millennials make up 25% of the U.S. population and 34% of the U.S. workforce, but you know, in the next 5 years, we're going to be talking about half the workforce, and by 2025, three quarters. So, and obviously that's not like groundbreaking. Every generation, the more time passes, becomes more of the workforce, but we're almost in line with millennials making up more than half. And so we're on our way to millennials dominating the workforce and not being sort of a niche. And I want to listen to some of the remarks from Heidi Zimmermeyer from last Thursday night. She was offering some comments from the business community, from the perspective of what they see, sort of piggybacking on some of what Anna says. Here is how they're viewing millennials at work.
I think we're seeing a very different worldview come out of this generation. And I see it in my own kids, and we're seeing it in the workforce. My particular organization has all millennials that work for it except for me. So, and I found it to impact the way the workforce, the actual workplace needs to be conducted. And I think we're seeing millennials demand a lot more out of their employers. There's a much stronger sense about locally produced things, about sourcing of products and foods. There's a sort of a meaning aspect to what you do in business, that it's got to have more than just profit motivation. And I think the lifestyle choices are different. This is a more urban generation, meaning people are preferring to live in urban settings. And it's changing the face of America's cities, and we're definitely seeing it here.
That's Heidi Zimmermeyer from Rochester Downtown Development Corporation offering her take on sort of millennials at large there. Listeners, I'd love to hear from you on, you know, what comes to mind? You hear millennial, is it a pejorative? Is it not? Does it mean innovative? Does it mean a generation that wants more feedback, more intrinsic value, you know, more meaning out of work? Or do you have those negative stereotypes, especially in the workplace? I'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And let me read a story that tells the story of why some people do have this negative view of millennials. Fair or not, I saw this shared. This is a story in March in the New York Times. The headline, "What Happens When Millennials Run the Workplace?" We could just ask Seth about that, but I'm going to go to the New York Times story. This story got shared everywhere, and everywhere I saw it shared, people were saying things like, "This is why I hate millennials," or "This is why I hate all millennials," or "This is why I never want to work with millennials." So again, fair or not, here's the story. It was the story of a company called Mike, M-I-C, that was created by and run by millennials. Their 28-year-old CEO, the Times reports, was tested when the company's director of programming was caught in a lie. His name is Joel Pavelski, and he requested a week off to attend a wake back in his home state of Wisconsin. Then, several days later, the CEO noticed that Pavelski was posting about his time spent that week building a treehouse. Pavelski wrote that he had felt burned out at work and wanted to rebuild a childhood treehouse as therapy. And the first line of his post was, quote, "I said that I was leaving town for a funeral, but I lied," end quote. In a disciplinary meeting the next day, Pavelski's supervisor acknowledged that he had been working grueling hours, so he was given another chance. But the CEO, the 28-year-old CEO, said he wanted to send a message that it was not a three-strike policy, that it was a two-strike policy, and he would not get another chance. But boy, everybody is sharing this story saying, millennials. Is that a cartoonish version of millennials, or is that typical to your experience? Annalise, I suspect I know where you're going with this, but what do you think?
It's a cartoonish, I mean, it's one story. It's an isolated incident. And I think the lesson learned is that this millennial-founded company, which employs primarily millennials, it was a fun place to work that offers the fun millennial-friendly perks that many tech companies in Silicon Valley and New York City offer. And they were forced to come to terms with an incident where, you know, an employee shared something on social media. We're all guilty of oversharing on social media in our generation. And they had to alter their disciplinary policy. So it's just an example of a company learning a lesson and having to step up to the plate and discipline somebody.
Did you see, you saw the story when it came out?
I did, yes.
I mean, did you cringe as well?
Yeah, of course I cringed. I mean, I just think it's a one-time incident, and it's something that a lot of people glommed onto as an excuse to criticize millennials.
Okay, Andre, what did you think?
I mean, I don't see anything there that seems like it's bad about millennials. If he actually had been going to Wake, he should have gotten the time off. And then when he lied, disciplinary action was taken by the millennial CEO. So it seems like it's more of a story like what happens when you let liars work at your business. But
lying is not unique to millennials.
It's not
anyway.
Unique to millennials. It's part of the human condition. You know,
millennials invented lying.
Yeah,
right.
I knew it.
And I think that when we're gonna look at that, we should look at it as an example of, like Annalise said, a company learning. You know.
So in other words, Andre, you would view this very differently if this was a story of someone who came in and said, damn it, I want a week off to build a treehouse, and I'm entitled, and you must give it to me.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not what happened, and I think that's how some people were reading it.
Okay. Seth?
No, I totally agree. I think it's blown way out of proportion, and it's exactly what Andre said. It's someone was caught in a lie, and it just so happened to be this young company that, someone could point the blame on, and I think that's the end of it, so...
And Seth, your company would encourage an employee leaving to go build a treehouse, right?
Oh, heck yeah.
That's what you guys do.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That would not seem weird at all.
Let me grab a couple phone calls here. Rick, first up. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah. I think your guest and your topic today is talking the small percentage of what you have right there in your studio. But I think most millennials are stuck with either without a job or a small job working for a giant corporation, stuck in the same rut that the country's been stuck in for the last 20 to 30 years. So I think you got to look a little bit broader on the millennial thing. I think a lot of millennials are just like the people that grew up 10, 15, 20 years before that. That's my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Rick. Trish on Twitter says essentially the same. What do millennials want? Jobs. We want jobs. What motivates millennials? Steady employment. Anna, you're nodding at that. Agree?
Yes, absolutely. I don't know, Evan, if you've heard about this thing called the gig economy. So right now, a lot of millennials are working 2-3 different jobs just to keep a full schedule, working for remote networked companies, doesn't come with a lot of benefits or any at all. It also creates some tax issues, but it's creating difficulty. But millennials are kind of stepping up to the plate and filling their schedules in unique ways.
Okay, Andre?
The gig economy is not one of the alternative economic models that we promote at RockShare. And although, some sharing economy models end up getting kind of giggy. There are ways to fix that. But I mean, one thing that you got to keep in mind is often when people say millennials, the code is for higher, more affluent white millennials, because these are the people are talking about the tech industry when they're talking about millennials often. And so that does ignore, larger unemployed groups of people who, don't have the privilege to be able to get into some of these industries. But I do think that the people who do have the privilege to get into some of these industries, the things that they're doing, pushing for things like everyone in a company getting the same bonus for democratic control over decision-making in a company, that's going to be beneficial to people all the way down if they are conscious about using their privilege to do that.
Well, a couple of very conflicting comments right along those lines. Misty writes to us on Twitter and says, I feel like a lot of millennials want to be coddled, whether in college or the workforce, and people are pressured. thanks to campaigns to fire or something else, and they are capitulating to the millennial herd. But Brian Van Etten, who is the chef and owner of the Playhouse and Swillburger, he says, maybe I'm surrounded by a special group of driven individuals, but millennials I know are the hardest working people out there. So very, very different takes there. You know, again, so maybe we're in the overgeneralizing business here. But Seth, you see those totally opposite. How do we get to a point where we have such opposite views? Maybe it's like Andre says, sometimes millennials is code for privileged white upper class, and sometimes it's not. What do you think?
Well, I think that the gentleman who had called in, Rick, I think he raised a really good point that I touched on the other day. And also, I think that Andre had just shared that. I think that what is being broadcast in the news is a very hyper-focused pinpoint to the overall generation that's now out there monopolizing the majority of the workplace, or maybe not so much the majority if everyone is still continuing to look for a job, if they're working two or three jobs at a time. But I think the bigger thing is that a lot of these millennial-driven companies that are getting the focus are tech-driven, service-driven companies that you know, account for a very large growing portion of the economy, but there's a large portion in the food and service or food and beverage service sector, the hospitality sector, your manufacturing sectors, all of which still are employing or being run by millennials like Brian Van Etten, but it's not really being talked about. And that, I think, is one of the more challenging industries to try to figure out that implementation of, whether it be a more flexible workplace or trying to bring more people into your company or organization's culture.
I don't know if Brian is technically a millennial. Brian, you got to let us know. You're right on the edge, my man. I don't know. Let me grab Bob in Rochester, who's been waiting to jump in as well. Go ahead, Bob.
Hello there. Good to talk to you.
Sure.
First, a comment. And the comment is that you read a list of companies that are catering to millennials. They are, without exception, second or worst best in their industries, without exception, which means they're catering to a group of people who they wish to employ in order to perhaps improve their market position, but they're doing so out of desperation or need. The second is that you have a group of people who you call millennials who are refusing to understand that they are employees. They may get and they may not get what they wish, but if they don't get it, they have two choices. They can continue to work for their employer under terms that they don't deem to be satisfactory, or they can quit and move on. The whole thing is absolute nonsense. You have a bunch of spoiled young children who pretend to be, to use a comment that was made a second ago, employers and employees. Well, they're not employers and employees. They're employees by and large. And they're not very sophisticated, and they're not very thoughtful about what it needs to drive a company and the economy.
All right, Bob, can you...
Catering to these people will not do it.
Bob, can you hang on the line for a second there?
Sure.
Okay, stay there. Because I want to kick it over to Andre, because this is a good chance to open up a discussion that that piggybacks on Bob's comment. I want a response on what Bob is saying, and I also want to talk about what you said on Need to Know this past Thursday night on WXXI-TV, which is that millennials want an opportunity for leadership. But I just got an email from a listener saying, why do millennials feel entitled to come into a company and have a leadership stake or a vote in anything? They're employees, and they should act like it. So that kind of dovetails with what Bob is saying. What do you make of that? Go ahead.
I think this is an overall change in culture. This isn't just millennials. This is how our culture is changing. We're seeing a growth of things like democratically run companies, you know, cooperatively owned companies. We have a local one that we were just talking about outside. Once again, Nut Butter. It's a democratically run company. And we're finding that you can actually achieve more interesting things, achieve better things when you involve everyone in the running of the company. But also, we're seeing that we're switching over to a sort of industries where you need innovation. And to get innovation, you can't have these strong hierarchical structures that you used to have. You know, that's how you get Kodak. That's how you get people that they're not able to change. But when you have these structures that are less hierarchical, that involve everyone in leadership, and also that get lots of people of differing mind, lots of people of diverse backgrounds into the same place, that's when you're able to become something like Google. That's how Google is able to constantly innovate. That's how Apple is able to constantly innovate, is that they're actually taking and flattening that structure and allowing for more collisions, and those collisions create ideas.
All right, Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think we're talking about two different things.
Okay.
Having a company that is flat in terms of interaction among employees and among people who innovate, it's a terrific idea. I've spent a good portion of my career in the software and internet services industry. That's different from running the show. That's different from deciding what it is that you will have in the way of benefits. It's different from deciding what the work ethic shall be. How you channel that work ethic, that's an entirely different issue, and I agree. We need to have interaction, and Google's not a bad example. There are others that are probably better examples, but it's a good example. But if you look at so-called democratized companies, they by and large do not succeed unless they are run from the top.
Okay, so Andre, a thought there. He's saying run from the top, you know, that's the difference. Go ahead.
I mean, I think that we need to look at how much time we've had to see some of these different systems work. But also, you know, when you look outside of America, in actually the area of Spain near Barcelona, there's a large company. I'll have to pull up the name. I can't think of it right now. It's one of the largest manufacturing companies in the world, and it's entirely cooperatively run. Everyone votes on everything. It's one employee is one vote. One employee is one share. All the profits are shared. And this is, a company that has been surviving the world economic downturn much better than other companies because they were able to have a flexible structure that allowed them to move funds around, move people around. And, you know, so we're starting to see some of the advantages. When you had, a big, powerful economic engine moving forward, then you could afford to have this, you know, regimented army of economic workers moving forward. But things aren't that certain anymore. You know, things are moving around, things are flexible, and companies need to adapt to that. And I think that, we're still in early days, and what we're going to see as time goes on, that these flexible systems are more adaptive.
All right, Bob, one more follow-up. Go ahead.
Sure. First of all, there's another company in the United States, a name of which I can't remember, that has done basically the same thing, and they're reasonably successful. But the fact of the matter is, you can't have direction by democracy. It doesn't work. Somebody needs to have a vision, implement the vision, and ask people to come along in terms that are acceptable or not. If they're not, they need to be gone. It's really, really not very complicated.
Bob, thank you for the phone call, and that is, it's probably its own hour of discussion.
Yeah.
on can you have, is Bob's premise true, that you can't have that kind of success with companies that are not run so essentially top down? So I need to do some homework before I can dig back in, but I want to thank Bob for that call. Andre, go ahead.
I just want to mention that the company is Mondragon. It's the Mondragon Cooperative, if anyone wants to look it up.
I recall, because we talked cooperatives about a year ago on this program. Cleveland has seen some cooperative work. Rochester's got a few. In the agricultural side, there's some.
Yep.
You mentioned nut butter. There's
and we've
a
got a
market.
Plan designed that the city actually bought. So
okay.
We're in the second phase of that.
And I recall reading about Mondragon, but I'll have to go back and do a little bit more homework there. So, Andre, it's always good to get homework. Thank you. And Bob as well. Hey, I appreciate that call. We've got more. The phone ringing here. Let's get our only break of the hour. I'm going to come back to your phone calls. I also want to ask Anna about something else she said on Thursday night on Need to Know regarding unlimited vacation and flexible benefits. I'm of the belief that there's no such thing as unlimited vacation, because if you don't have a set amount, if your boss says, hey, you can take out as much time as you want, you just got to get it approved and, you know, we'll work it out, you feel guilty every time you ask. I think that it's not good. I don't know if that's exactly what you meant, but we're going to come back and talk about what unlimited vacation means, flexible benefits, what millennials might want there, and we'll come back and get more of your phone calls as well. So short break, and we continue with the panel next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we take a look at the Rochester City School District's new proposed code of conduct. And we'll welcome Adam Urbanski, president of the RTA, talk about some of his concerns that he has shared about the code of conduct going forward. Then in our second hour, The Finger Lakes wine industry gets ready for one of their biggest events of the year. We will preview the Rosé Soirée. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Maura and Julie, we're coming to you on the phones in just a moment as we continue our discussion on millennial work culture and millennials in the workplace. Without trying to overgeneralize too much, Annalise brought a great article in that we've shared on our Twitter account about the sort of the perils of overgeneralizing about millennials as a generation, millennials at work. So that is a point well taken, but we do think that there are some distinctions that can and should be made, and that's what we're doing this hour. Annalise is the Managing Director of Business Development at GRE, Greater Rochester Enterprise. Seth Eshelman's here, the founder of Stash, and Andre Primus is here, the founder and director of RockShare. And before I get back to your phone calls, I had mentioned before our short break that, Anna, you said on Thursday night, millennials like, in general, flexible benefits, and that sometimes includes things like unlimited vacation. I was suspicious about that one. What did you mean by that?
For good reason. Well, my sister in New York City just accepted a new job at a marketing agency that offers unlimited vacation packages, and that was one of the reasons why she accepted the new job. It's something I've read about in Fast Company and elsewhere as this innovative benefit offered to attract younger, talented workers. And yeah, you're right. It's a catch-22. You get unlimited vacation, you're not going to want to take literally unlimited vacation.
I'm taking 4 months off
you're really guilty.
There's no way.
But it's also helpful. Like, let's say, you know, you actually have a funeral to go to. You want to take a week-long sabbatical, work remotely, and, you know, get some R&R. You're not going to be looking at the calendar and making sure you're checking off all of your vacation days. It makes it a little bit easier and more flexible. But it's absolutely spot on to say this is kind of a trap. It could be.
I can't imagine if I had no set vacation days that I'd be taking very much because of that feeling that, oh, well, you're asking for more. I guess we have to. I mean, that's a dynamic that you'd have to really feel comfortable with. And maybe you could get there. Seth, with your company, you've mentioned that you're kind of exploring that. I would want to make sure that the management is really means it when they say, we don't want you to take 6 months off a year, but we want you to take what you need. What do you think?
Right. Well, I mean, that's the one fun thing about growing a company from the ground up. You know, we've been discussing a lot of companies and organizations that have existed for a number of years, if not some decades, you know, talking about Apple or Google. You know, Stash is only 10 years old. You know, we haven't figured out everything yet. We've been a benefit corporation for the past 3 years. And by bringing the benefit corporation, I don't want to say policies, but by bringing those values into our workplace, we've been able to explore other things like a cooperatively owned organization, which we're now in the very early stages of trying to kind of figure out the ways about how to bring that on board. Obviously, talking about vacation time or something I touched on Thursday, which is paying your employees to volunteer, you know, allowing them to take a day and go and choose to volunteer at a place or an organization of their choice. And while we don't have these policies formally written and part of the, you know, the culture, these are things that we're trying to grow our yeah. business into. And they might not work. It could be a downfall, and we have to learn from that and move forward. But I think the interesting thing is that we're in a very open economic climate that we can try those things as a company, and we don't have much to risk. You know, our employees have some ownership for being involved in that conversation and seeing what they want out of the organization, and then at the end of the day, we can make a decision and go from there.
I don't know that there's a normal when it comes to vacation anymore for full-time employees, but I know that a lot of companies, you start with 2 weeks. I don't think that's enough. I don't think it's healthy. Mm-hmm. If I were an executive of a company, and it's easy to say this, but I really believe that employees are more productive when they are more rested and sort of more balanced. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks a year is not enough.
Yep.
You're trying to cram in maybe 5 3-day weekends to go see friends or family or deal with personal issues, et cetera. And then
right.
maybe one vacation week a year,
right.
not enough. And so, Andre, you know, you kind of indicated earlier that pushback, that balance, it's not about I want to work 6 months out of the year, but it's about saying maybe that 2 weeks is not enough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that I talk about with people when they're asking about, you know, alternative systems of management or alternative economy systems is they're harder. It's the fact that you are not distancing yourselves from people by using certain set policies, the fact that you're being more flexible means it's harder. It's harder to say, oh, I need this time off. You actually have to deal with the emotions of, oh, I'm guilty for taking this time off, or, oh, I feel like I really need you, but I also feel like, you know, I want you to have some time. And, you know, not everyone's comfortable dealing with emotions in the workplace, you know, but I think that's something that people are learning, that young companies are learning. And I think that when you have that flexibility, like I said, it gives you more resilience in an economic climate that's a little off, and it gives you opportunities for innovation.
All right, let me get to the phones. Every phone line is filled, and we're going to move as quickly as we can, starting with Maura in Rochester. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm 26, about to be 27, so I'm right in that line of millennials, and I really think, like, meaningfulness in the workplace is a huge issue with most of the people that I know. I have multiple friends, multiple people that I went to college with who left higher-paying jobs, myself included, to go to something where I felt like I was contributing more. I have a very, very close friend who's got a master's in human resource with a dual master's in psychology, who has stayed at a job where she makes $11 an hour because she loves the company she works for. And it's just so important to feel like you're contributing and like your bosses and your company really care about your investment back into that corporation.
Well, and do you sense, though, at some point, though, Maura, for someone who's making $11 an hour, you're going to have to make a values choice, or is that something that you think will continue?
She's looked at it, and she's spoken with her boss, and she's willing to invest more and kind of make sacrifices in her personal life, looking at moving up and making more eventually. But we're in our mid-20s. If you're not going to take time now to invest in what really matters and invest in a job that you care about and working your way up in that job that you care about, you know, when can you do it? When you're 35 and have kids, it's just not as easy.
Yeah, Maura, thank you very much. And the panel, quick reactions, any surprise there?
Not at all. That's why I work for GRE. I mean, I work for a nonprofit. I very well could go into the private sector and probably make more money, but I like working for an organization that has a mission, which I'm passionate about. So.
Yeah, we find the same thing. We have people interviewing for jobs, and you know, Stash has a policy of paying a living wage for any starting employee as part of our values of the organization. But beyond that, we have, you know, people who just openly say in an interview, you know, I'm not sure where the salary range is, but I really love the values that your company embodies, and I want to be part of it. So how can I do that? And it's just totally unprompted. So it's interesting to see that shift, that, you know, people aren't, you know, the bottom dollar obviously still buys you food and, you know, puts a roof over your head, but it's interesting to see people weighing values over dollars.
What's a living wage, by the way?
Currently at Stash, I believe I'd have to check with our paychecks representative, but I think our current living wage that we're paying for single in this county is, I believe, around 16, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. It may have just shifted, but I'm pretty sure it's close to that.
Andre Primus, some thoughts there?
Well, I think that, you know, if people are going to be weighing these things, this is a group of people who they started entering the workforce when there weren't any jobs. And if there are very few jobs and they're all low paying, you may as well take one that you want to do. And so as, you know, more and more jobs appear, people still have that attitude. You know, if I have all these different jobs, why not do the one that I want to do? And so I think that that is an unintended positive side effect of an initial jobs market that wasn't great. And I think it's really interesting.
All right, Julie and Brighton next up. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi there. Love your show, first of all.
Thanks.
And second of all, I was born in the 50s, so you can probably figure out that I'm in my 60s. And I have such a frustrating attitude towards other people my age who put down millennials. I think it is our generation, first of all, who probably created most of these young people. So if they
logically,
have a
I think that's probably right.
Attitude, where did that come from? From the parents, right?
That's probably right. But do you actually call them out on it? Do you have a conversation with them when you hear people disparaging millennials?
All the time. I work at a local college. I work with a lot of people my generation, but we're serving the young people at the college, and I call them out all the time. We had, from our generation, we were called every name in the book with Woodstock and everything else, you know, and we were always put down by the older generation. I think it's a very common problem by the older generation putting down the younger generation. And you can't do that. You can't generalize like that. And like I said, every day I feel like I have to defend the young people because they're just being young people trying to get a job and trying to make a life for themselves. And I get very frustrated with people my age saying, lumping them all into, you know, people who don't want to work and things like that. So I feel very strongly about that.
Well, I can see. And Julie, thank you so much for the phone call and the kind words about the show. She makes a great point about Woodstock. You know, they took plenty of grief for that. That generation turned out to be okay. You know, so maybe it's a time-honored American tradition of constantly being suspicious about the next generation. Sometimes it's technology related. Joe on Twitter says that what distinguishes millennials is it's the first generation that has come of age entirely in the internet age. So you have been digitally connected for most of your adult life, if not all of your adult life, which probably leads to feeling more mobile in workspaces, that you would like to have a little more flexibility in mobile workspaces, which millennials apparently in many cases do. But also, you know, there's also a little bit of suspicion about technology. That's always the case, too. You know, I talked to somebody last time I was in California. He said, you know, I'm trying in my 50s to hang with millennials when it comes to technology because I don't want to be the guy who's like, those millennials and that technology. I want to be relevant. And the second I feel like I don't understand what they're doing, I start to sneer at them. And that was an interesting idea there. So it's the technological generation for sure there. But that was a nice phone call. I mean, like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know. We're called digital natives, Evan.
Is that the term?
One of the terms used to describe our generation.
We're also
known for being very emotionally intelligent and being constantly wanting to learn. So we pick up new technologies when they enter the workplace.
Can we stop at some point, though? I mean, like, at some point, do we have enough? Like, would you just stop?
Yeah, but if they had said that back in 1960...
I'm mostly kidding. But digital native, that's the term?
Digital natives, yeah.
I haven't heard that. Mm-hmm. Steve is next up in Rochester. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, hey. Hey, Evan. I'm a big fan, too. I have some of the same... a few of the same comments as the previous caller. I teach at local community college, and I'm 40, and I'm sort of a bit of a slightly young Gen Xer. I love millennials. I think it's really interesting and fascinating for me every day to be teaching and working with millennials. I think it's kind of, one thing that's kind of interesting, one observation I would have is, because I think like Gen Xers are much more likely to sort of, at least from the professor's standpoint, I think Gen Xers are much more likely to, if they get a C or C plus, they're more likely just to kind of accept their fate. Whereas I think like, millennials are more likely to kind of question things and want to strive for higher grade and whatnot. I think that I think millennials tend to just question authority in general. I think they're really going to change everything. I think in a lot of ways they're the greatest generation 2.0. Whereas I think Gen Xers were kind of like the ultimate middle generation. We get along with everyone. I think Gen Xers I think millennials are going to really change everything. They're just less. Also, they could accept paradigms. They're more likely to question authority. They're more tolerant. I think it's true they maybe were a little more overparented. I think Gen Xers were sort of underparented in the 80s. But I think overall, it's going to be really good. I think they're going to really change the world in a positive way.
Thanks for the phone call and a lot of interesting comments, especially on the overparenting side. I'm reading just a ton of feedback here that has come in on email and social media as well. Yes, us non-millennials do understand some social media. So on Twitter, Joe says there's a great TED Talk by Ricardo Semler, the CEO of Semco Partners, titled How to Run a Company with Almost No Rules. That's maybe a good tip. Rich says another reason companies use unlimited vacation is they won't have to pay out unused vacation days when employees leave. It's a money saver. Interesting point there. And Steven says, pretty sure Google and all of Silicon Valley failed the diversity test, being mainly male, white, and of privileged background. I've read some of that recently. New York Times Magazine had their annual sort of business issue, and they looked at new efforts to diversify workplaces. Very interesting article there. And to Steven's point there, let me ask the panel, if some of what Andre's saying is true, and it kind of falls in line with what Steven is saying, that when we talk about millennial values, sometimes it's code for privileged white. How do we make sure that those values, if the idea is these are more healthy values, balance, et cetera, how do we make sure that
this generation feels like there's equal opportunity, Andre, that there is, this is not just a conversation about one segment of the population.
Mm-hmm. The only way to do that, so a hallmark of privilege is entitlement. And when you feel you have entitlement, you're willing to walk into a place and say, I want unlimited vacation. People who are underprivileged don't feel entitled. They feel like they need to work for everything, and they feel like nothing is going to be given them. And so the only way that you're going to get people from marginalized groups into these companies is by going out and seeking them. So young companies, old companies, if they really want to have a diverse workplace, you need to go out there and pull people in, because only the people who feel that they have privilege are going to be the ones knocking on your door. Everyone else is going to, it's almost that Gen X feeling, like he said. People feel like they had to accept their fate or work within the system that's been imposed on them. And only a select few people actually feel like they can escape that system. And so if people aren't, trying to go in and show people, here's an opportunity, then people aren't going to see those.
Annalise, what do you think?
So I think we're at an inflection point in history, and our generation is 80 million strong. We're the most diverse, ethnically and racially diverse generation in American history. So I think we're seeing, particularly in Silicon Valley and some of the bigger regional economies and these big tech innovator companies, there's a changing of the guard that's taking place. So a lot of times the board of investors, the board of directors will be older, Caucasian males, but we're starting to see the needle move more towards diversity, just as our generation gets older and more active and assumes more and more leadership positions. The workplace environment is becoming more and more diverse. So I think all we have to do is look to the future to see progress.
Let me ask Seth, who is the founder of Stash. Sarah writes to us on Twitter, Seth, the reason I want to buy your product is because of your values. So she's appreciating what she's hearing from you.
Sure.
And she's saying when she understands a company's values and appreciates them, she wants to be a customer. It's good for business. From your perspective then, let's talk a little bit more about the values on the diversity side.
Sure.
Is that a value to you, and how do you overcome the hurdle sometimes of making sure an applicant pool, for example,
right,
is not monolithically racial in one way or another?
Right. And I guess I'll touch on two things. First, Sarah, thank you. That makes me really happy that's something that you've been able to find not only out of about our company, but that the values that we promote and that we hold on to, that we lead our company with, are helping you to, make your decision out in the marketplace. So first of all, thank you. Secondly, I wanted to touch back on a question you had asked me about living wage. I looked it up while we were taking a call.
Okay.
And it's a lot lower than I thought it was.
Oh.
Not for the company, but for Monroe County. It's not even $11 for a living wage in Monroe County for a single hourly full-time person.
It's an affordable place to live here.
Mm-hmm. At Stash, we are a starting hourly at $15. So I did confirm that.
Okay.
Just wanted to fact check that.
Okay.
But back to your question about diversity, as far as an interview or job pool goes, that's actually a challenge that we are facing right now. Stash is going through essentially version 2.0 ourselves. We're about to expand into larger business. We're growing nationally, and we're taking on larger clients. This means we're obviously needing to bring in more people into the workforce, whether it's management in the office or people on the floor. So that's a huge challenge that we're facing as far as pulling in that diversity in the job pool and interviewing from anyone who's looking for that position. So I would say if people have resources to tap into, I would love to hear where they are, because that's one thing that we're running into.
Andre?
Just one thing. I think that we need to also keep in mind that hiring diversely is good, but investing diversely is going to be even better, because there are so many great business ideas coming out of low-income areas, especially in Rochester, that are succeeding, you know, beyond what should be expected of the resources that people have available. And there are so many of those that aren't succeeding because they don't have the right resources. And I think that if we have diverse investment in poor areas, we're going to really see a boom in new businesses in Rochester.
All right, let's be very quick with our last couple of phone calls. Dan and Webster, try to make it tight. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, Evan. All right, love you guys. I got to say, though, I also love your caller, Bob, from earlier, despite the fact I disagree with him. I think he conveyed an idea that the millennials are flippant in general towards employment. I think he's missing the economic reality, especially after 2008. I graduated in December 2009 and have been laid off four times in 6 years. Three of those jobs simply no longer exist because those departments or businesses are gone. Now, but enough about me. Even more interesting, I think, is that his sentiment was an illustration of the fundamental opposition between capitalist, and laborer inside capitalism. Plenty of millennials, among people of other age groups, are extremely uncomfortable with the textbook capitalism. You know, we see the exploitation all over the world. But it's also in part because we're more educated and therefore see the inevitable wall that capitalism races toward. That's why we see reconfiguring of capitalist structures, especially by millennials. While some would suggest we even scrap them all entirely, but what these millennials are doing is raising an interesting question. Can capitalism, if it's radically reoriented, work and not kill itself as it, you know, will and some say must if it continues on its traditional path?
Dan, thanks for the phone call. And I know some thoughts are, we're almost out of time, but go ahead, Donna.
Oh, certainly. So I think, you know, he made a lot of excellent points. Our generation has been marked by this notion of job hopping. It used to be considered a bad thing. Now it's necessary. I mean, if you want to increase your earnings, pick up new skills, the average tenure of a millennial in a job is about 2 years, just out of necessity. Over a quarter of our generation reported in a recent survey that we expect to have six jobs in our lifetime at least. So it's out of necessity.
And so much of what Dan said goes back to what Bob, previous caller, said, and sort of the debate with Andre, and the question on the future of capitalism, how this generation views capitalism, how it views the utility of capitalism sort of in egalitarian terms and as a value generationally. It's a very interesting question. It deserves future study. And again, so Dan, Bob, and others, I'll go back and study some more, and we'll come back and talk some more about that. I want to thank our guests, great guests this hour. Andre Primus, founder and director of RockShare. Thank you, Andre.
Thank you.
Great seeing you. It's always nice to have someone with a much richer radio voice than mine. It's Andre. Anna List, Managing Director of Business Development at GRE. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks, Evan.
And Seth Eshelman, the founder of Stash, STAACH. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Being here. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you Thursday.